This is NASCAR driver Tony Breininger inviting you to make a pit stop at Raising Cane's for my favorite craveable chicken fingers. Turbocharge your order and get it even faster when you order online or with the Raising Cane's app. Raising Cane's chicken fingers, one love. Raising Cane's is not affiliated with NASCAR.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello and welcome to New Books in American Studies. I'm Benjamin Concannon Smith, your host and history teacher at Wachusett Regional High School. Before we begin, I'd like to thank you for listening in on this podcast for the New Books Network. Today, I'll be speaking with Jennifer Anderson, Assistant Professor of History at State University of New York at Stony Brook. The topic of our conversation is her recent book, Mahogany: The Costs of Luxury in Early America, out in 2012, from Harvard University Press. The title does not lie. This book is literally about mahogany. That's right, wood. Mahogany, as Anderson contends, provides a remarkable window through which to view the complexities of early American life. Unlike ephemeral goods like sugar and tobacco, which were purchased by elites but consumed and discarded shortly thereafter, mahogany was something solid, something lasting, something passed down to subsequent generations. Social engagements revolved around mahogany. Elites coveted the ornate and beautiful furnishings, which, because of its incredible density, could only be made with mahogany. And even the middling classes would indulge in purchasing a mahogany piece when it was affordable for them. But I'd be shortchanging this book if I were to say that that's all that it was about, the dissection of the social world in early America, for it does much more than that. It also tells the darker, hidden story of human and environmental exploitation. Anderson traces the wood from the slave hands that cut it down in the West Indies to the polished tables that they became in the posh estates of America's upper class. By doing so, Professor Anderson manages to blend the social story with the environmental history and the history of capitalism behind it all. Thank you, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Professor Anderson, welcome to New Books in American Studies. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you for your interest in my book.
And I'd like to start this interview, as I do with every author, by asking what brought you to this project?
Well, I got interested in this topic initially when I was studying at the Winterthur Museum in Wilmington, Delaware, which is one of the United States' premier collections of decorative arts. And it has a fantastic collection of mahogany furniture. And when I was a student there at the time, I became intrigued with the prevalence of this tropical hardwood that I saw. And there were examples there that came from Massachusetts, from Philadelphia, from the Carolinas, all over the United States. And I was curious about why people in those regions, which I knew were ones that had ample forest reserves of their own, you know, why would they be importing this tropical hardwood? And the curators at the time knew quite a lot about these artifacts, but sort of the backstory of them, they weren't very knowledgeable about. And so I was left with a lot of unanswered questions. And I went out and became a museum curator and worked with collections and historic sites that had still more mahogany objects. And so this question sort of dwelled with me.
Right.
And later, when I had the opportunity to go back and get my doctorate at New York University, I was looking for a dissertation topic, and I actually went to visit Winterthur looking for inspiration. And I had a conversation very memorably with the librarian there at the time, whose name was Neville Thompson. And I said, I'm looking for a topic that would allow me to pursue my interests in people and in nature and in objects. And she stepped back for a moment and she said one word. She said mahogany. And I took that as an oracle. And I said, yes, of course. And that sort of reminded me of these earlier musings that I had had and set me on the path to actually go and explore this from the perspective of an environmental historian, but bringing with me that background and material culture that I had gained at Winterthur and working as a curator.
Right.
So trying to sort of bring those different perspectives together in this work.
Right. And that's definitely true. I mean, if you look at just Atlantic trade during this period, most historians tend to focus on sugar and tobacco and obviously slaves. So what made mahogany different? What did you find out?
Well, one of the things that was pretty immediately apparent was that the nature of mahogany production was very involved, because basically what people were harvesting in the 18th century were these very massive trees that required a lot of effort and labor to even begin to extract them from the rainforest.
Right.
And unlike many other tropical commodities that were being grown on plantations where people could, you know, plant more or expand or contract production, depending on what the agricultural setting was, with mahogany, they were actually taking it from the forest. So it was more of an extractive industry than an agricultural industry along the lines of other plantation grown commodities.
Right. And then how about the consumption side of it? I mean, there are some major differences there as well.
Well, one of the things that I was very interested in was the way in which mahogany objects not only gain value over the course of the 18th century, but they tended to retain it, because the nature of mahogany was that it was solid and strong and long-lasting, and so people would actually, you know, keep these objects and pass them along and bequeath them to other people or sell them. So the objects themselves got histories, if you will, provenances, which you don't really see with other kinds of more ephemeral things like sugar or tobacco.
Sure. So I guess just delving into the history of it all, could you talk a bit about how an 18th century person in colonial America might experience mahogany on a day-to-day basis?
Well, one of the things that I was really surprised at was that my initial impression that was that mahogany was something that was a very elite material, and that only the very upper crust people in a place like colonial America would own mahogany.
Sure.
But while I discovered that that was true in the early years of its popularization, which really around the 1720s to maybe around the 1740s, by about the middle of the 18th century, you begin to see it in lots of different contexts and different levels of consumers, as well as in public settings. For example, I found instances of mahogany tables in local taverns, even in kind of rural areas.
Right.
So it had sort of become part of the material landscape of colonial Americans by the mid-18th century. So that really surprised me that it became as ubiquitous as it did.
So you mentioned in the book that it was almost serendipitous that mahogany became the sort of upper class idealistic piece of furniture, I guess, or timber that it became. So if you could talk a little bit about why you think this, that would be wonderful.
Yes. Well, the thing that I think is rather intriguing about mahogany, as I said, it becomes very, very popular, but it still retains sort of elite connotations. And I think that the reason for that was that in large measure, the qualities of this particular wood really resonated with people in the 18th century with ideas of what they regarded as beautiful.
Right.
So, for example, the wood as I mentioned, was very strong and dense, which allowed it to be used for very exquisite carving, and it also could take a very high polish. And so during the mid-18th century, when the sort of Rococo fashion begins to flourish in England and then later in colonial America, mahogany as a raw material really lent itself to the kinds of furniture that people were making in that style.
Right.
And so there's sort of this interplay between the material, physical properties of the wood and the aesthetics that people really appreciated during that particular time period.
Right. So, and you mentioned, too, that in England, using mahogany was almost a necessity because of deforestation, but that's not the case in North America, or it wasn't the case, was it?
No, and that was another one of these sort of slightly counterintuitive things that I discovered.
Right.
Is that exactly as you say, in England, the importation of woods, not just tropical woods, but all kinds of woods coming from Scandinavia, from Germany, from North America, as well as from the West Indies, where mahogany was being initially extracted, really was important to the economy in the British Isles, which were suffering pretty
right.
severe deforestation. And then by contrast, in colonial America, they had wood, lots of woods, and in fact were exporting large quantities of timber to England and to the West Indies, ironically, importing tropical hardwoods and exporting their own temperate types of hardwoods,
right.
pines and other such oaks that could be used for more utilitarian things in the West Indies. So what I argue is that in colonial America, there wasn't so much a need for the timber as there begins to be this desire that's motivated by the aesthetic qualities of the wood and by what they see happening in England in terms of it becoming, a prominent feature of the elite material culture initially.
I think that's one of the things I found most fascinating as well, that I just did not expect. People in England using this out of necessity, and because they're using it and because they're the metropole, Americans sort of follow in lockstep.
Well, it's always sort of an interesting question, and not all historians agree on this, of sort of the degree to which American consumers were, partaking of what they call emulative consumption.
Sure.
But it seems to be something that you do see in the example of mahogany.
Right. So it varies based on commodity.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So I guess if you could describe the process underfoot in the mahogany trade industry, sort of walk us through what it takes to create a mahogany table from tree to table. That would be great.
Well, what I look at in my book is a couple of different geographical settings where mahogany was being extracted.
Right.
And each one was slightly different depending on the terrain and the labor regime that was available. But I think a really good example of a place where the mahogany trade became really important was in a place like Belize, which is a small country in Central America, which during the 18th century was actually Spanish territory.
Sure.
It became a very contested area because the British, as they become enamored of mahogany and use up other sources, want to go in there, and so it becomes a very politically charged situation, and ultimately the English have to negotiate with the Spanish to gain access to those trees.
Right.
So that's sort of the first dilemma that has to be resolved. But then the second big challenge in terms of extracting mahogany, as I mentioned before, was that these trees were really large, and
right.
they were being brought from rainforest settings, which had not really been accessed on that scale before. Some woodcutters had been doing other kinds of smaller scale woodcutting, but to access these huge trees, some of which would be hundreds, maybe even thousands of years old, was extremely dangerous and labor intensive to cut the trees and then to actually move them. And so one of the things that I got really interested in and that I explore in quite a lot of detail in my book is the way in which these particular demands of production help to spur an expansion of the use of enslaved laborers. So although you see English and Anglo-American woodcutters coming in to take advantage of this natural resource, those people who actually were providing most of the heavy lifting, the actual labor to fell the trees and load them and get them down to the waterways, because they usually, these massive trees would be floated down out of the rainforest to the coast and then loaded on ships. All of that very arduous work would have been done by enslaved Africans.
Right. I know you just mentioned a few, but can you talk in greater detail about the differences between slavery, let's say being a slave on a sugar island like Jamaica, and being a slave in Belize tasked with cutting exotic wood like mahogany?
Yes. Well, it was certainly a very large difference, and one that mattered to people who found themselves enslaved in one of these settings or another. And in fact, it's quite possible that people who ended up working in the mahogany forests in Belize may have spent time in the West Indies, possibly on a sugar plantation, before they end up as woodcutters, because in Belize in particular, many of the slaves were being imported through the markets, slave chattel markets in places like Kingston and Jamaica.
Right.
But the difference that you see most markedly is that whereas the sugar plantation regime was a very relentless, hard labor, where people would have been having to work really year round in very harsh conditions out in the fields or in the boiling houses to process the sugar cane and boil it, boil out the juice and
right.
have it, crystallized into sugar. All of that was very regimented sort of labor that required a lot of supervision and people working often under pretty close supervision. What you see in the forests of Belize is very different, in that in many instances, these crews of woodcutters, which were predominantly male, I should say, would be sent out into the forest during the dry season, and often only with an overseer. They would make a base camp, and then smaller crews of men would go out into the forest, oftentimes really on their own recognizance. Mm-hmm. So what seems to have been the case was that it was a more flexible form of bondage, in that the people enslaved as woodcutters actually had some degree of mobility and autonomy as they went about their business of going through the forest and finding the trees, felling them, and then bringing them back. And because of the conditions that they were working in, it forced their masters and overseers into a situation where they often had to negotiate with the slaves about what their working conditions were going to be.
Right.
So not to say that it was in any way a kinder, gentler form of slavery. There certainly was a lot of punishment and oppression, to keep people at this task. But you also see instances where there were systems of rewards, for example, or other kinds of incentives to try and encourage the slaves to work as productively as possible. So it's a little bit more of a give and take situation than you see in the very rigid setting of a plantation.
Right. Yes, but I can't imagine dragging a 100-foot log through, the jungle is easy.
No, it was hard to imagine. And actually, I would say, even still today, that logging is one of the most dangerous occupations today, even with all kinds of modern equipment and safety, considerations, but even more so in the 18th century. And so slaves who actually were able to survive in that challenging environment and who learned, you know, how to find the trees and how to safely fell them, et cetera, they actually became valuable to their owners and, you know, gained prestige even among their own community because of that knowledge and that expertise. So in that sense, you know, there develops a very, you know, a different set of social relations than you see elsewhere in the Atlantic.
Yeah, it's definitely really interesting how you sort of identify the different spheres of expertise. And it seems, as you mentioned, that no one really understood the entirety of the trade as a whole. Slave units that would go out and there'd be experts in finding the trees, cutting them down. But then, you know, once they're on the boats, then you have the middleman merchant expertise of how to pick the right trees, how to load them onto the boats correctly, which markets to try to sell them in. So if you could talk about that a bit, like, so let's say the trees are loaded onto the boats. What happens next?
Well, that actually, there's some very vivid descriptions sailors in the 18th and early 19th century exactly of that process, because that too was rather tricky, of having to get these massive logs, because the value of the wood would be greater if you could deliver a log that was of a larger scale that would then, you know, translate to a larger piece of furniture.
Right.
So the wider the boards, the more valuable the wood would be. So transporting those was very tricky, and the sailors would be trying to do this often while the ship was rolling at sea, being able to heft the logs on board, pack them securely so the ship wouldn't roll.
Right.
And all of that with, you know, sharks circling below. It was quite a labor as well. And then from there, these ships would be sailing to many different seaports. And I found ships leaving Belize that were heading to place, you know, ports up and down the eastern seaboard of North America, as well as to places like London, Liverpool, Dublin, as well as further afield to Stockholm or St. Petersburg. Similarly on the other end, this wood would be offloaded. And at that point, by the mid to late 18th century, they actually had special people whose job it was to survey the mahogany coming in. And they would measure it and grade it for quality.
Right.
And all of that happened before, you know, a cabinet maker then would go down and either select the wood straight from the dock or perhaps work with a timber dealer who would be doing the initial selection and milling of the wood. But as you say, there are all these different spheres of knowledge, and, you know, each different stage of this process involved different people. And I was really trying to sort of find the stories and each put these different pieces together to get the whole picture.
Right. And I think you did a great job in doing so, I must say. And you mentioned as well that early on in the trade, there weren't operations that were just solely bent on delivering mahogany. It was sort of a commodity among commodities in these shipments, right? It wasn't a sort of
sole venture. Initially, it tended to be more incidental to other trades, and I think often that was done as a way to sort of balance out risk among different commodities. One of the things actually that was intriguing to me as I began to try and trace different people was there were certain individuals that I saw who would move from one stage of this process to another. So, for example, there were people who started out in New England working as sailors on board ships who later became woodcutters in Belize.
Right.
Or cabinet makers who developed particular expertise in selecting and using mahogany, who would be dispatched by their cabinet making firms down to places like Cuba or Haiti in order to select the wood themselves on the spot as it became more difficult to source mahogany. So these spheres of knowledge were not necessarily completely isolated from each other, but you see sort of a flow as people begin to learn the different nuances of the business.
Right. It's almost like a very, you know, rudimentary early form of credit checking as well, right? They were checking out other people's operations for quality and reporting back to...
Exactly. I mean, all of this sort of early mercantilist system required a lot of trust on the part of individuals. And so the importance of having, you know, good networks of connections, you know, either based on people that you had worked with in the past or that, you know, friends of friends or family members. So one of the ways that I actually was able to sort of trace this industry was by looking at the personal connections among different, you know, merchants, woodcutters, sailors, et cetera, that these networks of people follow the economic networks, if you will, or underpin them.
Right. Okay, so now I want to turn the conversation a bit. I mean, if you were a very successful merchant at this time, even if you thought that mahogany was too risky to engage in, you know, with that trade, you were probably consuming it in some form. So my question is, I guess, what were some of the most popular objects made out of mahogany during that period, and what social functions did they serve?
Well, that's a great question, and it's interesting. The objects that become sort of the most in demand among merchants and other elite consumers initially are objects that were inherently had aspects of display to them. So, for example, dining tables were one of the most prominent ones that I found, and other kinds of small tables, which, of course, in, you know, for an 18th century merchant or planter, the center of sociability would be around his dining table. And there actually were sort of rituals developed about sort of how the table would be uncovered at the end of the meal before people were served dessert, and the unveiling of the table became a little bit of a ritual. Right. And it was, it was considered, you know, a mark of a person's refinement and sophistication that they would have a beautiful table to show off in this way. Other prominent artifacts that you would find in a house, and that, you know, many of them survive in American museums and historic houses today, were things like desks, which oftentimes also might be in a space where a merchant's customers would be coming and going, as well as bookcases or sideboards in dining rooms. So some of these objects actually were quite monumental in scale, and you look at those and you can kind of almost, you know, look through them to imagine the size of the tree that must have contributed to those artifacts.
It's incredibly right, and some of the images in the book definitely show that, you know, a single piece of mahogany for an 8-foot dining table had to have come from a ginormous tree.
Exactly. And I wish I could have included more photographs, because, you know, one of the things that is so striking about mahogany and that has been an endless fascination to me is that there are no two pieces of this wood that really look identical. You know, each one is unique. Right. And, you know, I think part of the reason that, you know, this becomes, you know, has retained its value is that, you know, some of these, the quality of the wood is so beautiful. I mean, it strikes you. It's sort of a visceral response that many people have to this material. And I think that in a way that makes them kind of timeless.
Talking about the how easily identifiable mahogany was, especially during this time period, in knowing what it was worth, I think it's a little bit odd, and you do bring it up in the book, that people were actually using mahogany to make coffins as well. Can you talk about that?
Yes. Well, I have to say, I was surprised to find how prevalent that becomes, that, you know, not initially, but by the end, certainly by the late 18th century, you do see this, and I was able to get a sense of this by looking at the account books of cabinet makers in which they would record what they were producing.
Right.
And so, for example, there are several cabinet makers in New England and Philadelphia where I was actually able to go through their account books over several years and see the what they were using for making coffins and the growing prevalence of mahogany, usually for their high-end products. And so as with all of these, you know, different types of artifacts, and, you know, just as today, you can go and buy, you know, the deluxe model of bar, for example, or you can get sort of the stripped down version without all the bells and whistles. Similarly, if a person went to the cabinet maker and needed to buy a coffin for a loved one who had passed away, they would be presented with a range of options from the least expensive, which would probably be a pretty plain pine box, right up to sort of the Cadillac version of a mahogany coffin, which oftentimes would be further enhanced with silver handles and perhaps a nameplate. So, you know, again, that was a form of conspicuous consumption that probably didn't mean so much to the person who was in the box, but apparently really was meaningful to people who chose these. And whether that was, you know, to honor their loved one, or if it was a sort of a showy form of impressing the neighbors, it's hard to say.
No, I found that very interesting, nonetheless. So you mentioned already that by the mid-18th century, owning finely crafted mahogany furnishings became a mark of status. So for the listeners, can you describe how you came to this conclusion and sort of what types of things that historians look for when making such claims?
Yes. Well, what I was looking for was initially, you know, when do you begin to see mahogany showing up in people's the records of their households and of their domestic consumption? And I was sort of looking at this from two ends. One, from looking at the records of cabinet makers of what they were producing. Right. And for whom, and the range of materials that they had on an offer. When does mahogany begin to show up initially? And then how can I trace it becoming increasingly prevalent, as well as ultimately different qualities of mahogany, which is something we haven't touched on, was over time, as I said, it becomes very common that people would be using mahogany, even sort of middling people, but they might be using a less expensive mahogany versus someone who is still buying the better, best quality wood. So looking on that end of how what cabinet makers were offering, presumably in response to their clientele's desires and demands. And then on the other end, I was actually looking at what people had in their households. And one of the ways that I would get at that was by looking, for example, at people's correspondence about what they were choosing for their households. Okay. So oftentimes when a young couple in the 18th century was married, there would be records and correspondence surrounding the setting up of their new household, where I could find mentions of what they were choosing in selecting their furnishings and to what degree mahogany was prevalent among that. And then to get sort of a sense of how this fit into the context of their household property as a whole, and over time, I would look at things like probate inventories, which were usually inventories taken at the end of someone's life. And one of the things that's very striking in looking at many, many probate inventories from households of different levels and different regions is that in descriptions of household contents, it was very, very common that if an object was made of mahogany, the probate inventory, the people who were taking the probate inventory would specify that. And occasionally they might specify other woods as well, but not to the same degree or the same consistency. So it seemed to be that it was important for them to mention that. And that's why I argue that that suggests, you know, that there was sort of value added to an object that they would specify that it was made of mahogany.
Right. I also loved how you mentioned how mahogany appeared in portraits. I think that's a very instructive medium to look at when you're looking at what's important to people in this time period, because it's not like you can just take your phone out and Instagram a picture of something back then. I mean, if you were to have a portrait done by John Singleton Copley, for instance, that would have cost a pretty penny, would it not?
Yes, it certainly would. And that was probably one of the more elite objects. And one of the things that's intriguing about that is that with portraiture, as you suggest, it was something where people really had time and motivation to think carefully about how they were presenting themselves to the world. And Copley, you mentioned, becomes a real expert at painting not just beautiful images of people, but also beautiful images of mahogany furniture.
Right.
And we believe that, in fact, some of the objects that he had may not even have been owned by the people whose portraits he was doing, but he used props in his own studio. And so the same mahogany table might show up, or the same chair. But the idea that it was evoking this sort of aura of refinement around the person in the portrait seemed to be something that was very much in the fashion.
And I guess you could say it was these same sort of pretentious showings in objects that were the target of growing resentment among the lower classes in the years leading up to the American Revolution. Is that right?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I have seen in a number of different settings, both in the lead up to the American Revolution, and particularly with some of the mob actions surrounding disgruntlement over the Stamp Act and other instances like that, where you see colonial Americans reacting against people that they saw as representatives of the crown or representatives of colonial authority that they were resisting, that the trappings of their status become marked for people's anger. And indeed, there are often descriptions of this, of people dragging out the mahogany furniture from, you know, the wealthy man's house and destroying it in the street and stomping on it. And, you know, on the one hand, it's interesting that the reporters who are describing these events mention that it's the mahogany this or that. I think particularly because that was to underscore the incivility of these actions. And on the other hand, you know, this happens so often that it does seem to me that these objects were targeted as having particular meanings for people that in that moment represented sort of a stand-in, if you will, for the people who they were angry at.
Sure. And what effect did the revolution have on the trade?
Well, basically, what you see in the wake of the American Revolution is, well, first, during the war itself, of course, there's a disruption of normal trade. And then in the wake of that, there's a bit of a realignment as areas that had been British, you know, part of the British Empire, become less accessible to the United States, and other areas such as the French islands and Spanish islands of the Caribbean, where American woodcutters hadn't really been involved, become more accessible. So there's a bit of a realignment among those different areas. So, for example, woodcutters in Belize, at least for the immediate years after the war, seem to be sending more of their mahogany to England rather than to colonial America, suggesting that some of those earlier ties had been at least temporarily disrupted.
And so I guess that brings me to a good question. You mentioned earlier there's a distinct difference between two different types of mahogany that you're talking about. You just mentioned Belize, but I believe the more coveted wood was Jamaica wood, as they called it, Jamaican mahogany. Can you talk about the two different types?
Well, that's interesting. That's where the sort of ecological aspect of my story becomes important, and I really have tried to cast my book not just as a cultural and economic history, but also an environmental history.
Right.
And that really goes back to your point that the two different types of mahogany that people had access to and that were commercially exploited in the 18th century basically represented two different species of this tree we call mahogany. And the one species was native to a very limited area of the Northern Antilles, so Jamaica, hence the name Jamaica wood, but also islands such as Hispaniola, which is today, of course, the Dominican Republic, and Haiti, as well as Cuba, and even the southern tip of Florida, but a relatively constricted area. And because the natural range of that species was so limited, those trees actually become pretty well depleted early on in the 18th century, and hence sort of spurs the need to find other replacements. And although that was the wood that sort of set the standard, and I and other historians actually have talked about Jamaican mahogany, this West Indian mahogany, as being sort of the gold standard that people initially demanded. Okay. Over time, they increasingly had to seek out other sources of mahogany. And so the species that was native to Belize, sometimes called Honduran mahogany, is one that has a different quality of wood, but the trees tended to grow larger. Right. So people over time, and it's interesting actually looking at the objects, you can in some instances get a good guess as to where and when that object, the wood for that object may have been made, judging by the scale and quality of the wood.
Right. But merchants and companies would often try to fake the look of Jamaican mahogany, wouldn't they?
Yes, there was a lot of deception, and so it's actually a little tricky for even the best furniture connoisseur, or even experts in wood identification, to know exactly which of these species it might be. It's not always possible to discern that.
Well, I find that fascinating, and I also found it fascinating when you were talking about non-renewable depletion in the context of the Enlightenment. Enlightenment era thought, was it seen as less problematic?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, one of the things that was kind of a surprise to me, and that I have since gotten very interested in, was how early on you do see people in the time period, even in the late 17th century and into the early 18th century, commenting with concern about the fact that they see the forests being depleted, whether to clear land for sugar plantations or to, produce mahogany for fine furniture. The notion that it would be possible to actually deplete what seemed initially like these endless rich forests.
Right.
Comes as a little bit of a wake-up call for people, but actually translating that concern into policies of how to regulate or control the extraction of tropical timbers is much harder to actually do. So Richard Grove, for example, has done some really interesting research trying to look at how ideas about ecology and natural resources begin to kind of enter into people's consciousness. He wrote a book called Green Imperialism, which talks about this, and that was really influential for me in thinking about, how people's awareness of mahogany depletion actually begins to shape their consumption patterns and behaviors.
Right, and it almost seems like concern is sort of hedged by the fact that, men of science are sort of always coming up with solutions to things. So at first it seems like, well, yes, the forests are depleting, but we'll figure out a way to replant them and, we'll successfully farm them. But that doesn't happen with mahogany, right? It's very difficult, as you mentioned. What's difficult about, farming mahogany trees?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about mahogany is the way in which it's very much interconnected as a species with the larger ecology of the rainforest.
Right.
So when forest was clear cut, for example, the conditions that mahogany would grow in normally under the wild would be more or less destroyed. And it turned out that in trying to cultivate mahogany in a plantation setting, that it became very vulnerable to various kinds of invasive pests. And then trying to restore rainforest was difficult to do after it had initially been destroyed. You couldn't get sort of the same mix of species, et cetera. But what exactly all the different factors are that go into creating, an optimal habitat for these mahogany species that have been, they are all now either endangered or, you know, severely depleted, and there are restrictions on the harvesting of mahogany today, and people are cultivating mahogany, but it is often not necessarily in the same places where the trees originally grew.
Right. That's interesting. And so talking about depletion again, how did changes in technology in the early 19th century, which is, you know, when these trees were pretty depleted, change the mahogany industry?
Well, one of the things that I argue that becomes a very important moment is the development of new kinds of steam technology. And this begins in the early 19th century and really intensifies by around the 1850s. And it affects both the extraction of mahogany and the way the wood is then processed into furniture. And what happens during that period is that the places where mahogany was still available, and as I mentioned, some places had already been depleted by then, and particularly in the Caribbean and Caribbean islands, but in places like Belize, the advent of steam trains and steam launches allowed people to get greater access deeper into the rainforest. So it actually increased the rate of deforestation and of depletion of mahogany in many of the areas that suddenly were open to mahogany harvesting that hadn't been accessible previously.
Right.
And on the production end, the advent of other kinds of steam technologies, such as saws, band saws, and other kinds of equipment that was used for processing the wood, it allowed for greater efficiency. And for example, people began to use many more mahogany veneers, which were now being sliced up very, very thin using new steam saws. And it was you can get much more veneer out of a single log than could ever have been done using hand saws. But at the same time, you see an explosion of consumption that many, many, many more people suddenly have access to these less expensive veneers. And so ultimately, where people initially had said that, oh, you know, this technology would be something that would help conserve mahogany, it actually has the opposite effect of, you know, increasing production, increasing consumption.
Right. So you're, on the one hand, you know, preserving the resource by cutting thinner veneers and getting more out of each piece, but on the other hand, just going through much more wood much more quickly.
Exactly.
And you just mentioned how veneers democratized mahogany, allowing more people in varied classes to purchase it to some degree. How did the upper classes respond to this?
Well, there, I think you see, as is often the case, there's sort of an effort by people who see themselves as being in the elite sphere and who are the high-end consumers, is that they really sought to differentiate themselves from more middling consumers by either buying higher quality mahogany veneers, which were always available, or they, by the mid-19th century, they begin to seek out other even more exotic woods like rosewood and ebony that become popular during what we would call the Victorian period. So there's a proliferation of different kinds of exotic woods. But mahogany still retains its specialness, but it becomes, you know, there are different grades of mahogany that separate some people out from others, or so I argue in the book.
And you said that mahogany sort of waned on the cultural, plane in the 19th century, the late 19th century, but it still held deep-seated cultural connotations for many Americans. Could you talk about what you mean by that?
Well, it never really goes away. As I say, you know, mahogany there becomes part of a larger repertoire of exotic woods that people are using in the 19th century. But I think even still today, if you say something is mahogany, it does have certain connotations of quality and elite status that most people kind of understand what that means. So it's interesting to me that has continued, even as, you know, mahogany, as I said, it's a protected species now, but it's still being used, for example, for making fine yachts and you know, really high-end furniture.
Right.
But lower grades of mahogany are routinely used for making things like decking on people's houses. So sort of the reality of how it's being used versus sort of the cultural associations people have with it don't always exactly align.
Well, I guess I just have one last question, which is, do you think that there are modern lessons to be drawn from your book? That's often like the worst and most difficult question to receive, but I have to ask it.
Yeah, well, you know, I think the thing that I hope that readers come away from my book with a new appreciation for is that these objects that today are, you know, celebrated as masterpieces of American craftsmanship. So if you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art or the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, or you go to Monticello or you go to Mount Vernon, you will see beautiful mahogany objects that were used by the founders of this nation. But what I would hope my readers would have also an appreciation for is that these objects also represent this tremendous investment of labor, of people who worked under often very harrowing conditions, as well as an investment in nature, if you will, because they really represent, you know, a generation of generations of tropical forests that were destroyed 200 years ago, and this is what's left of them. As we think today about, you know, what the challenges are of our planet in dealing with questions about deforestation and all of the human and ecological consequences that flow from that, not least of which is issues around climate change, it is kind of a humbling reminder that the beautiful objects that people surrounded themselves with in the 18th century certainly came at a high cost.
Definitely. Well, I guess I lied because I want to ask one final question, which is and I have to ask this as well, because I'm just curious. Is there any mahogany in the Anderson household?
Oh, I get asked that quite a lot. And I have to say that I have one very small tea table that my husband got for me and that I value very much as sort of a symbol of this that I've done. But I keep all my finest mahogany I keep at the Metropolitan Museum here in New York, and anyone can come and visit it because it really is a shared treasure.
Well said. Well, thank you, Dr. Anderson. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you.
And thanks for listening. Again, Professor Anderson's book is Mahogany, The Costs of Luxury in Early America, out in 2012 from Harvard University Press. Till next time, I'm Benjamin Concannon-Smith.